Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 25, and I'm joined today by Jeremy Engels, who is Assistant Professor of Communication Arts and Sciences here at the Pennsylvania State University. Jeremy's work focuses on the rhetorical foundations of democratic practices. His first book, Enemyship, faces the difficult question of how to talk to the enemy and how that functions in political rhetoric and action. He has written numerous articles in democratic deliberative theory and is working on a new book entitled Dialogue Under Distress, which focuses on how our modes of democratic deliberation were stretched to the breaking point during the late 60s and early 70s. Today, he has come to the Digital Dialogue to discuss an article that recently appeared in the Quarterly Journal of Speech entitled Uncivil Speech, Invective, and the Rhetorics of Democracy in the Early Republic. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Jeremy Engels to the Digital Dialogue.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris. This is a real pleasure.
Well, I really enjoyed reading this article, and I think the best way to begin is to have you just sort of summarize it and give us a sense of what you were trying to do in the article and what the article's about.
Well, that's great. This is an article about Robert Owen's 4th of July address in 1826, which is the 50-year anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence.
Right.
It's also a pivotal moment in democratic history. Tocqueville is in the United States at this point, and mm-hmm. he's thinking about how democracy is functioning because democracy is gaining a legitimacy in the American public imagination at that time that it didn't have at the beginning of the century. And so I was particularly interested in looking at how people were talking at mm-hmm. this really pivotal moment. One of the things that I discovered is that invective, which going back to classical rhetoric, we could define as the rhetoric of blame,
mm-hmm.
Was rampant
right.
everywhere. And it was generally recognized in the scholarship to be central to democratic deliberation during the 1840s and 1850s. But one of the things that I saw is that it was very important in the 1820s
mm-hmm.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
An invective, going back to the foundations of rhetorical theory, as part of the epideictic genre,
right.
Which most people define as rhetoric of ceremony,
mm-hmm.
ceremonial rhetoric, rhetoric of funeral orations
right.
or things like that. And so I think it's appropriate that we see epideictic at this ceremonial moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what kind of led me to this article. I also was interested, I wanted to write about someone who, kind of espoused atheistic viewpoints,
right.
because we don't often actually see that in the rhetorical literature. There's a lot of great rhetorical criticism on people who are talking about Christianity or various versions of Christianity. I couldn't find anything on anyone who actually attacked Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
What I found when I actually read Owen's speech is that it was incredibly uninteresting. it was a pretty formulaic and boring speech
right.
in a lot of ways. The commentary actually was much more interesting
mm-hmm.
to me.
Well, actually, let me pause for a second about invective, because you
sure.
begin the article with a nice quotation from Noah Webster's American Dictionary,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which distinguishes invective from reproof.
Right.
And I thought, at least for me, it was really helpful to start thinking about the dimensions of, or the technical meaning of invective in that sense.
Right.
Do you want to just say something about that?
Well, sure. I think invective really is up for grabs, honestly. I think it's been defined in many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
The epideictic genre was invented by Aristotle. He drew together many different aspects of what he took to be ceremonial rhetoric.
Right.
I think Webster is important, as a lexicographer, and he was trying to cultivate an American sense of
right.
language, like an American English, an
mm-hmm.
English that would distinguish us from the English. So I thought his definition was interesting because he talks about reproof as coming from a friend.
Right.
And it's intended to, to rehabilitate, or it's intended to make better,
mm-hmm.
whereas invective is from an enemy, and it's not intended. It doesn't have that good intention, I guess, behind it.
I think that's a point I think I would like to circle back to maybe at the end of our discussion, because of a couple of things that have actually happened on my blog this semester.
Oh, okay.
Having an open blog with the ability to make anonymous comments, we had some interesting things that are, I think, directly related to that.
Interesting.
So I'd like to circle back to that at the end. But before we do that, I want to just clarify the invective versus reproof distinction, and reproof being something that is coming from a friend,
right?
There's this kind of sense of common purpose,
right,
and a sense of generosity, maybe.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Whereas invective is, according to Webster, that you quote, is from an enemy. But interestingly, at the end of your article, you mention how important intimacy is.
Right. I think intimacy, for an invective to be effective, I think you have to be intimate with the enemy.
Right.
You have to understand what actually is going to injure or hurt them with language in order to articulate invective. And that's something I don't think that Webster is really interested in, his definition.
Sure.
I think the relationship between praise and blame and friendship or enemyship is really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes interesting from the perspective of philosophical inquiry or rhetorical criticism. How do we distinguish invective from reproof? How do we see that textually or linguistically? What are the markers of invective versus something that's more friendly?
Right.
And it might be the sort of thing that we know it when we see it. I mean, these clearly were not friendly articulations towards Owen.
So I think it'll be helpful to get a little bit more content about the speech that Owen made, the Declaration of Mental Independence, made on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence,
right?
And because one of the things that's interesting is when I first started reading, I thought the invective was going to be Owen's, his speech being an invective, but in fact, it really turns out that it's the response to that speech that are particularly, I think, salient and also poignant in terms of elucidating the points you want to make.
Right. Yeah, I think Owen is interesting because his rhetoric really conforms to a lot of the Enlightenment ideals about rationality and public rationality, that the responses, they don't.
Right.
What's also interesting to me is that Owen's followers, they called themselves the Owenites, they attempted to defend Owen's speech by using very rational, calm, collected, reasoned arguments, the kinds of arguments I think that they found lacking in the public sphere.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're right. Maybe some context would be helpful. Owen is a wealthy British industrialist, and he comes to the United States to start what he calls a new moral world in Indiana, at this place called New Harmony.
Uh-huh.
And it's part of this is such a moment in the 1820s, this moment of social reform is incredibly trendy at the time.
Uh-huh.
And Owen's participating in that. So he comes to the United States, and he's a minor celebrity in a lot of ways. He meets with Congress. He has dinner with the president. So he's respected in a lot of ways in elite culture.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to this place called New Harmony, establishes this utopian community that actually is a very authoritarian community. His word is God's word, basically, in this community. But it's a community that practices equality for men and women, which is different. It's a community that tries to achieve some sort of equity in marriage. Marriages at the time were incredibly unequal. So in 1826, Owen gives this address, which people in the East don't hear about for a couple of months because news is incredibly slow at the time.
Right.
And the speech, he calls it, just the Declaration of Mental Independence. He's so incredibly pompous.
Right.
And the speech, that, if anything jumps out about the speech, is just the hubris of Owen. He's here to save America.
Right.
And he talks about how the Declaration of Independence inaugurated this age of enlightenment for him, but Americans hadn't carried it far enough yet. And so, I mean, this quote from the speech really sums it up. Mm-hmm. He says, "I now declare to you and to the world that man up to this hour has been in all parts of the earth a slave to a trinity of the most monstrous evils that could be combined to inflict mental and physical evil upon his whole race. I refer to private or individual property, absurd and irrational systems of religion, and marriage founded on individual property combined with some one of these irrational systems of religion." So the evils he talks about, private property, which is interesting as an industrialist, that he, you know, he's a proto-socialist in a lot of ways.
Right.
He talks about religion.
This is at a time, you make a point, that this is at a time when capitalism is just starting to get traction, and it's a time when a lot of, you know, American industrialists began to start making a lot of money.
Indeed, and it's in a context, in the American context of the Protestant ethic, that really preaches, you know, individual self-initiative and pulling oneself up by the bootstraps.
Right.
And I think it's a cultural moment, not unlike today, that really frowns upon any sort of systems of welfare or socialism or sharing,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then he attacks Christianity at a moment of the Second Great Awakening,
right.
At a moment in which the United States really is, in a lot of ways, becoming a Christian nation. People today talk about the United States being founded as a Christian nation, which is incorrect. I mean, you can't... If you go back to the actual documents of the founding of the country, you don't see it there. But there's a real movement in the 1820s to establish Sunday schools. There's a movement to suspend mail delivery on Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
And those movements are very effective. And so this is a moment in which the United States is becoming a more Christian nation. And here's Owen arguing that all religion is superstition.
Mm-hmm.
And then he attacks marriage at a time when, you know, divorce was not allowed legally. It was illegal in Indiana in particular. And he attacks marriage because, for him, it's a way of upholding a system of private property.
Right.
The man inherits the woman's property and then passes it on to his sons.
Right.
And so that system of passing things on, for him, is unjust. And marriage, too, is sanctioned by, you know, Christian doctrine for him. So here's this guy in rural Indiana attacking, you know, three kind of pillars of,
right,
American democracy in a lot of ways. And that's why I think you know, people railed against him the way they did.
And doing it, as you point out in the article, on the very day when Adams and Jefferson die within,
indeed,
5 hours of each other. And so there really is a kind of timing question that's really pretty interesting.
Right. That, you know, in rhetoric we talk about kairos,
right,
or, you know, timeliness.
Right.
It's very important for, you know, for discourse.
Mm-hmm.
So, the speech probably was inappropriate on the 4th of July anyway, but it became even more inappropriate as Americans learned of Jefferson and Adams' incredibly serendipitous deaths on the same, you know, 5 hours after each other on the 4th of July.
Yeah. Well, I wonder to what degree Owens was, in fact, inviting a kind of invective response insofar as, you know, he's appropriated the vocabulary of the Declaration of Independence,
right,
and done it on the 4th of July. Obviously, you couldn't have anticipated what happened with Adams and Jefferson. But and what you said about the fact, the strategy of response from his side, which was to be calm and,
right,
reasonable and try to articulate a position that was at least compelling in some degree, which, of course, didn't seem to,
right,
be hearable by those who were really threatened by what,
right,
he was trying to argue.
Right. I think protest literature often has functioned in that way, to try to provoke a seemingly hysterical and irrational response on the part of authorities, and then that allows the protesters to establish their own rationality,
right,
which is very clearly what happened in this case.
Right.
I have no idea if Owen intended it to,
right,
be that way or not, but it's interesting.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, it seemed to me that a main concern in the article for you is the response by the newspapers, by the wider American culture,
right,
to this.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think the response is interesting for a number of reasons. But really what I wanted to better understand is what was democratic talk like on the ground? I mean, right. We have a very general sense of what democratic deliberation should look like, or how we would like it to be or how it is. And we also have a very general sense, I think, of a kind of golden age of deliberation during the founding period. Really, almost up to this point, I mean, the so-called era of good feelings is ending. You have a deeply contested presidential election in 1824, and you'll have another one again in 1828. So I wanted to see how people are actually talking. I think that's important because how people are actually talking is a model for how people learn how to talk, democratically. And what was that model? How were people learning how they should conduct themselves in public? Was the question I was really interested in.
And what you argue, what you suggest, is that there's this real harsh and really reactionary kind of response. On the part of newspapers, on the part of public figures, that sought to identify Owen as a kind of enemy and marginalize him in all kinds of ways, calling him mad and using other kinds of invective language that really would marginalize him.
Right. Yeah. How does the democratic community self-police itself? I mean, how does it establish its boundaries, the boundaries of what is acceptable in public discourse? And I think that's one of the things that the Owen case demonstrates, is that how we establish those boundaries, but also maybe what those boundaries look like. Boundaries of, I mean, everyone agreed that the public sphere, if you want to call it that, or the public realm or public culture should be rational. But what does that actually mean?
But what you're suggesting is that the response to Owen was one that drew on a kind of conception of rationality, but also was in a certain sense irrational.
Absolutely.
In the sense that it was hyperbolic and harsh and disrespectful, right? So I wonder how that dynamic plays. Actually, it sort of plays in a strange opposite way with regard to Owen, insofar as what you're saying is that he was a kind of totalitarian leader in a certain way, in the sense that his word was law in his community, and yet it was in the service of some principles which we might agree now were pretty noble in terms of the equality of women and the questions of justice with regard to property. So I wonder how that sort of that dynamic between his manner of leading in a kind of top-down way and the performance of a response on the part of the democracy to his words that used invective in order to defend in a certain way its opposite, namely some kind of rational discourse.
Right. I think you're right. I think that starts to lead us into the tangle of democratic deliberation that's so much more interesting to me than often how we, in my own field, talk about democratic deliberation in a kind of ideal sense.
Right.
I mean, what do we actually learn from how democracy functions?
Right.
I think it's interesting just how tangled rationality and irrationality are in this case. When I started, I thought it was interesting that they labeled Owen mad, which was the charge that was repeated over and over again, mad as being insane.
Right.
And that got me thinking about Foucault's work on madness and how during the Age of Enlightenment, a sense of rationality was defined and solidified in opposition to something that was outside the bounds of rationality, something irrational. The irrational in Foucault cannot speak. And this case, I think, there's that dialectical process of defining an opposition, but there's also a sense in which irrationality is at the heart of rationality, or they're together.
Well, and I think that ultimately your article, if I read it correctly, is a real critique of invective as a kind of approach.
Yeah.
Without denying the fact that
it
happens and that we have to figure out what it means and how to address it. And yes. One of the things that you draw out, I think, really nicely is using Burke, right, the curative
right.
dimension of this kind of invective and the way in which it addresses some of the anxieties about right. democracy and about how Americans are thinking about themselves as a community.
Right. I think invective allows us to not have conversations that we maybe should have. Mm-hmm. Invective served a real deflecting purpose, I think, or function at this time. Owen made attacks on kind of, you know, just the foundational basis of inequality in the United States, talking about capitalism and marriage. And no one actually engages him on his own terms, his mm-hmm. own argument. No one tries to rebut his points. Mm-hmm. Instead, they attack him.
Right.
And so that allows, by labeling him as mad and crazy and insane, we don't have to listen to him, which right. means we don't have to engage in that serious conversation, that serious deliberative conversation we need to have. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I think that's true today yeah. as well, I think. By blaming someone, we don't have to listen to them.
Well, maybe I can circle back and tell you a little bit about what happened on my blog this
sure, please.
Semester, just because
yeah.
I'd really be interested uh-huh. in how this fits in, because as I was reading your article, I was realizing, you know, this is really fitting into some issues I'm thinking about mm-hmm. and actually living through. We as a community in my Philosophy 200 mm-hmm. class mm-hmm. have been living through. So we, about 2 weeks ago, I woke up Monday morning to find an anonymous blog post to one of my students, which was, as I was reading through it, you know, fairly well argued mm-hmm. and made some interesting and important points. But at the end of it, there was profanity and some disturbing kinds of language, not directly attacking the student. The language was directed to sort of, if you argue for this point, which was that communication is impossible. This was a post okay. that a student had made that was sort of only tangentially related to the content of the course, mm-hmm. but something that I fully supported because I was trying to get the students to blog not just about the content but also about the issues that are of concern to them.
Right.
So I was immediately faced. I got this. I woke up at 5:30 or 6 in the morning, and the first thing I look at is this comment, and I'm wondering, okay, now do I delete this?
Right.
And just shut it down. My decision was, because part of the point of the course was not only to study the Platonic dialogues, but to perform and to cultivate the habits of dialogue
sure.
in the class using digital media, that I said, okay, well, let me make a response. And my response was, you know, first of all, you didn't introduce yourself. We don't know who you are.
Right.
And we've had other people come on who have, you know, introduced themselves or at least don't speak anonymously. And secondly, we don't have a practice of using this kind of language in this community. And then I thought, okay. And I also said, you know, this is a class about dialogue and cultivating the excellences of dialogue. So the second comment after the post was, if you delete this, you're all cowards. This was before I responded. And I simply said, you know, it won't be about cowardice if we delete it. It will be because the community decided that you have acted irresponsibly in trying to insert yourself into the discussion.
Right.
And then I said, let me wait. But meanwhile, I have a pit in my stomach, you know?
Of
I mean,
course.
I'm living this, you know, when you talk about invective, mm-hmm. it's one thing to think about it, it's another thing to feel it and to worry mm-hmm. about your students and to think about how that plays out for them mm-hmm. and what it means as a faculty to let that, you know, profanity stand on a site that is really yours, but the universities and it's a learning community. And so I let it go mm-hmm. for and watched it. And my students, I mean, they just were so amazing in terms of how they responded. They responded with, you know, by turning this person and addressing the specific mm-hmm. content of the comment and, you know, holding him or her accountable for the language and, you know, mm-hmm. taking a strong stand on that. But they, you know, there's a couple of students who said, you know, got angry and sort of threw back some invective. But on the whole, and when that happened, I actually went on and commented and said, you know, this was a great point, but it would have been even better if you had left out the mm-hmm. the more invective kind of language. And They turned this whole thing around over the course of the day to the point where the person was starting to comment back and forth quite a bit on the blog. And the person sort of said, well, I'm going to stop this because I didn't want this to turn out to be a test of the community of the class.
Right.
And meanwhile, he's also trying to get me to engage about how digital media is not possible when you allow these kinds of voices of anonymous voices of disruption.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't write a response, but I talked to my class about it, that the response was there. They performed the response in their communal response. I mean, I opened up a back channel on Angel to see if they wanted me to shut it down. I said I'd be happy to shut it down, and they sort of, well, let's let them go a little bit. Some very interesting things happen. I mean, including the continuation of very angry, belligerent language.
Mm-hmm.
But the students really handled it. So I wonder there's an instance where also invective served to identify the community because we took ownership of what we were doing and we said, and there was a way, we didn't shut this voice out, but technologically shut the voice out, but we did, you know, put limits in terms of what we would respond to. And so I wonder how that plays. First of all, I'm just very proud of them for doing it. I mean, it was really remarkable, but it's caused me to think about how one responds to an approach that is disrespectful, disruptive, intentionally angry, and of course the whole dimension of anonymity is in this context, which adds another dimension which is not really in the context that you're talking about, although there were pseudonymous writers at the time, who were doing this.
I was thinking about invective in Plato. I mean, Plato argues that invective can be a learning moment in the deliberative process, that invective actually serves deliberate. I mean, Plato's not endorsing invective, but I think in Plato, invective might function in the way that it functioned in your class, that invective allows the community to come together and consolidate around our good deliberative norms.
I'll tell you, one of my students, Josh Testa, just in response to one of these things, quoted the line from Book One of the Republic where Socrates tells Thrasymachus, "Don't be harsh with us."
Right.
Just to me, I read that and, you know, on my iPhone alone in my house at one point as I'm trying
Did
to...
Did you cry?
I got tingles because it was saying, you know, here's a student who has seen that the issue that we're living through is, in fact, also something Plato wrote about. Think about the Thrasymachus encounter.
Right.
Think about Callicles.
Right.
In the Gorgias. And and so that's why I decided not to just pull it down and trust the community that we had cultivated over the semester, but I wasn't sure.
Right.
And that was a real risk as a faculty member.
It could have backfired.
It could have. And, you know, it's still up there, and, you know, who knows what it's difficult to find because you have to look through comments upon comments, but it's still on the website, and I leave it there because it is a testimony to what we've accomplished, but it's also... it's also something that I think is difficult as a teacher to take the reins off and see if your students can live something of what we were talking about in the classroom. And that was the experience that I have been sort of trying to process. There's a gut feeling. And so that's one thing about invective that is important. And I think returning to your article, really interesting because as you make the point, invective can so easily move into violence, can so easily move into a physical kind of contact. And so...
Yeah, I think that was a very real danger of invective in the 19th century, and it did slide into violence quite often. And that gets me thinking about... you know, I talk about invective against Thomas Jefferson doesn't lead to violence... Invective against Henry Clay does. And a lot of that had to do with the character of those politicians, in that Jefferson had the kind of character that didn't want to engage in violence, whereas Clay did. And I've been thinking just in the context of my own research quite a bit about, you know, virtue ethics and cultivation of character, the excellence of deliberation is very different than that's a different approach to deliberation than a lot of proceduralist thinkers would take, where all we have is the rules of the conversation. There's nothing preceding those rules.
Right.
And I think you had something preceding those rules. You'd cultivated a kind of character in the class that allowed it to respond to invective in a really productive way.
Yeah. Well, and I was going to say, it was interesting to see the responses, because I was twittering about this with colleagues and, and things, and a lot of them were saying, no, just shut it down. It's going to divert your attention from things. I'm saying, well, no, actually, this is part of the point of the course, is to see how we would respond, to cultivate responses that would actually not be destructive, but actually would push us in toward transform our community.
Right.
And I think that's ultimately what happened. But what was important was that that tendency, that desire to shut it down, and then another suggestion was, well, don't you have a set of guidelines or rules for how to conduct yourself on the blog? And I said, well, I have this really pretty robust rubric.
Sure.
But we don't talk about, you don't use profanity.
Right.
You can't attack ad hominem attacks. We don't have, that's not in there. But then I said, but we have a semester of practice.
Yep.
And so we don't really necessarily need to come up with a set of guidelines, you know, principles.
Right.
It's not about the procedures. We've been living a community here. And so I think there's something that's, you know, one of the students did post something about how we kind of expect people to behave and stuff on the blog. But, you know, that's fine. That's good.
Right.
And I think your point is really important, which is that it's about how do you cultivate habits of response?
Yes. Yes.
You know? It's not easy to hear somebody saying something belligerent and angry and to respond in ways that might push the conversation forward. I mean, I was experiencing this in some ways in the healthcare debate, too.
Right.
This summer.
Right.
You know, hearing a lot of invective.
Yeah.
And wondering how best to respond to that. And I actually found it therapeutic for me to be able to respond through blogging about it to people who I knew would be able to hear what I had to say, rather than direct confrontation of somebody who I think would not respect the position that I had. Now, that might not have been fair. I mean, I missed an opportunity maybe to transform or to be transformed in a way, too.
I was thinking about the anti-abortion protesters who were on campus this semester, as they often are in the fall. And, you know, that's a very, well, it's a very belligerent rhetoric. I mean, the very graphic pictures. And, you know, if you actually would like to engage someone, it's very difficult to do that. And I had a conversation in my class with my students, and most of them thought that we should just not allow those people on campus, that they should not be allowed to participate in our dialogue. And and my point was that this is a wonderful opportunity for you to practice good habits of citizenship.
Right.
For how do we engage those who spout opinions that we find abhorrent and repulsive? That, for me, is essential training for citizenship, I think. And I think that's the kind of training that you're providing your students, which is wonderful.
As a faculty member, it's hard because you have to live it, too.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the way in which it sort of happened in that class, and I tried to make it happen, was that I had to recognize I'm as much a participant in this community. And so in some ways, even though I could have been certainly within my rights as a faculty to hit that delete button, I felt like, well, it's really not only my decision.
Yep.
You know, it's our decision. And if we decide, and if at a certain point where I felt like there was danger or there was really something that we had to worry about, it would have been deleted. And, of course, I also modeled the way I thought one should respond. Mm-hmm. Namely, I tried to respond in a helpful way that pushed things forward. But then I wasn't responding to the individual questions that this person was asking in ways I didn't feel were acceptable.
Right.
So... And it was handled that way. But this actually brings me to the point about Penn State energy future that we've been playing with and working with in the Rock Ethics Institute.
Right.
I think there's an example where you have a potentially a very antagonistic kind of encounter where you have students protesting the coal plant, And it, just looking at what we have on the web now through The Rock and the things that Mark Fisher has produced with the interviews of the mm-hmm. various kind of stakeholders, mm-hmm. it is a great testimony to what can happen in an academic institution when faculty and staff and engineers and students, administrators come together and talk about it in a way that recognizes that we all have a stake in this, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the kind of deliberation that's not superficial. I mean, we often hear calls for more deliberation, but we don't think through all of the requirements that have to be put in play for that deliberation to occur. I mean, deliberation isn't easy.
Right.
And I think that's the thing that you know, my students often find incredibly frustrating, is that, you know, deliberation requires restraint, mm-hmm. deliberation requires a sense of enlarged vision, an ability to see mm-hmm. What the other person or side is arguing. And it also involves, you know, respect, not just
right.
tolerance, but actual
right.
respect.
Right.
How do you respect someone that you don't respect?
Right.
That's
right.
really
well,
difficult.
And that would, that's what made this mm-hmm. incident on my blog, our blog, mm-hmm. So interesting, because if it were just belligerence, if it were just invective and nothing substantive philosophically said, then that would have been an easy call.
Yep.
It wouldn't have been in it. But as you saw this person respond, they were, first of all, they were addressing specific issues and actually responding in ways that said, if you were able to hear,
right.
that this person was, you know, intelligent and had some things, right. real important points to make that I thought were not... would have been easier to hear if it weren't made
yes.
under the guise of this invective. But
right.
Still, you know, some my students, I was really happy that they were able to hear and address those points in the ways in which I think you're talking about the newspaper wasn't doing with Owens.
Indeed.
They were not addressing, you know, well, what's the deal with public with private property, and
right.
you know, what are the real issues about, you know, religious fanaticism and other things that we might as a community really need to think through.
Right.
What about the treatment of women in 1820s? I mean, you're talking about 100 years before, you know, the suffrage.
Yep.
And that's you know,
he was very prescient in a lot
yeah.
of ways. It's interesting to think about invective. I argue in the article that anti-Owen invective allowed people not to listen to Owen. And what I hear from your example is that sometimes those who engage in invective, it's difficult for us to hear them as well, because that invective blocks
right.
getting at the message.
Right. But I think there's something else that's happened that's of the flip side of maybe mm-hmm. what you're arguing mm-hmm. in your article, because there is a sense in which that experience that we had together as a community of how to handle this
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
drew us together and made us think about who
Absolutely.
We were, who we are, and who we want to be, in a way that was, I think, ultimately very productive because we responded in
mm-hmm.
a, I think, mature and respectful way.
Yep.
Whereas what you're suggesting is the maybe the obverse of that, which is that responding with invective has a temporary cure of
mm-hmm.
making one feel better and consolidating a sense of unity and a sense of who we are as a democracy or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but that's a short-lived one, in the sense that it's that it will always require another moment of exclusion or a moment
mm-hmm.
of even violence.
Right.
And that's actually the point that you were making about war at the end, I think, was a pretty interesting one,
mm.
particularly as it relates to contemporary politics.
Right. Yeah, the thing that I thought was very interesting about this invective, and I think about invective in general, is that it seems to me to be inherently ambivalent, in that if I respond to you with invective, that might be a curative moment in which I feel better, or it might be a moment in which I don't have to actually engage your points.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a moment that admits the validity or the strength of your points, because
mm-hmm.
why would I get so riled up?
Mm-hmm.
Why would I need to engage in invective
yeah.
if there wasn't something mm-hmm. valid or strong or truthful about what you have to say?
And you make a great point at the end about insecurity.
Right.
The question of insecurity. Namely, it seems to me that kind of response invective as a response, and even in violence, mm-hmm. I would say, mm-hmm. is a sign of a kind of insecurity, a kind of powerlessness, a kind of helplessness.
Right.
He says, oh, this is all I can come back with.
Right.
Is, you know, an ad hominem attack or
right.
whatever.
Well, I think for me, one of the most difficult things about living in a democracy is we have to live with insecurity all of the time, uncertainty, because nothing is certain.
Mm-hmm.
Even the things that we consider to be true right now could be reevaluated right. in the future. In a democracy, I'm always putting my fate in someone else's hands, and we don't know what they're going to do. And so, I mean, that's really why, you know, I find the rhetorical tradition so valuable, is rhetoric has always been about how do we live with uncertainty.
Right.
How do we live with decisions that we can never know are absolutely right
mm-hmm.
or true?
Mm-hmm.
And I think invective is a problematic way of dealing with uncertainty. It's
right.
a way of displacing uncertainty into the future,
mm-hmm.
making it go away for a little while,
mm-hmm.
rather than engaging it full
It's
long.
Really a kind of dogmatism in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's an inability to, you know, live in the
right.
vagaries of that ambiguity.
Right. Right.
One point, which you know, I know we have other chances to have a discussion about this, but this your comment about the rhetorical tradition is I think exactly right on, and it brings me back to a conversation I had with Chris Johnstone and other
mm-hmm.
and others on the digital dialogue about
mm-hmm.
You know, whether philosophy itself can also embrace that
mm-hmm.
element of its tradition, right? Which is
right.
to say that it's not about the answers; it's about a way of questioning. It's
right.
about a way of living in the ambiguity of.
Right.
Of human finitude.
Right. That's where I think rhetoric and philosophy are on the same page.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I think that the battles between rhetoric and philosophy are overblown, I
yeah.
think. I mean, you know, Plato was absolutely right to criticize the sophists in a lot of ways,
mm-hmm.
the vacuousness of sophistical discourse. But there was something in the sophist as well, kind of training for civic life, I think that was really important.
Right.
And I think that, thinking about how do we argue under conditions of
yeah.
uncertainty, I think that's, I mean, I think we're absolutely on the same page there.
Well, maybe we could go back, just as a way of ending,
sure.
To Epideixis, and
mm-hmm.
because when you were mentioning that at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
you referred to Aristotle, but I was
mm-hmm.
thinking of the beginning of the Gorgias, where
mm-hmm.
the distinction is between an Epideixis and a Dialegisthai.
Right.
And of course, what Socrates wants to do with dialogue in that dialogue is you know, perhaps a bit problematic insofar as he wants to impose a kind of a short answer,
right.
you know, dynamic, a more
right.
Technical dialectic on the conversation, although there are reasons. I don't think it's about short answers. I think
mm-hmm.
it's about, you know, real engagement that
mm-hmm.
he's ultimately after. But I wonder what we can say about Epideixis in contrast to or in combination with dialogue,
mm-hmm.
Also because of the points that you were making in the article, which is really that Epideixis is... from epideignomy, which is about pointing and
mm-hmm.
showing, right?
Yes.
A certain kind of showing. And
yes.
you, I think, even talk about not only Burke, but John Quincy Adams, who was
right.
talking about the...
To point the finger.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
You point the finger at somebody, this is a blameworthy person, this is a praiseworthy person.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder how these two ways of showing, or
mm-hmm.
this way of showing as epideixis, a kind of pointing,
mm-hmm.
can also be powerful...
Mm-hmm.
for genuine dialogue,
mm-hmm.
because it does, I mean, models,
mm-hmm.
paradigms
mm-hmm.
are important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for me, rather than going to the Gorgias, I
yeah.
go to the Phaedrus, to
uh-huh.
the third iteration of love. You know, Socrates' argument, which I think, for me, is kind of a Platonic model of a good rhetoric.
Uh-huh.
And in that dialogue, I mean, epideictic and deliberative rhetorics, I mean, they're always engaged. I mean, it's incorrect to try to carve out a deliberative realm that's, you know, excludes epideictic, I would think.
Right.
And I think, you know, people like Chaim Perlman or Kenneth Burke would argue
mm-hmm.
the same thing. Aristotle would
yeah.
have argued that as well. I think part of the deliberative task is to point the finger of
right.
praise and blame,
right.
Because it's not as though every option is equally praiseworthy or blameworthy. I think we have to have those resources to be able to live democratically, to be able to point that finger of praise and blame.
Mm.
Are there better and worse ways of doing that? I'm sure that there are.
Well, and there is a way in which, and I've been trying to do this with my students and also in my own work on Plato, there's the performative dimension of the dialogue mm-hmm. really helps show forth a certain way of interacting mm-hmm. with others that is praiseworthy or blameworthy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when Thrasymachus mm-hmm. does what Thrasymachus does, you can right. see how that is a threat to...
When Callicles does what Callicles does, absolutely.
And then sort of how do we respond to those real situations? One of the things that that was so poignant for me about all of this is that, you know, in this semester with the experience I was talking about earlier, it was a gut learning that I was undergoing. Mm-hmm. And when you say invective is not easy to deal with, it isn't. And yes. when you are concerned about how to respond in a way that's not, there aren't rules to follow at that
point.
That's right. You know?
Right.
And you have to feel it in yourself somewhere. And if when you feel that, your response is to throw up a wall mm-hmm. or to throw a, or to, you know, react violently mm-hmm. or with more invective, mm-hmm. Then that's a kind of response, mm-hmm. Which is understandable because mm-hmm. that feeling in your gut is not pleasant.
Invective, to me, is very effective. Yeah. I mean, it invites an effective response, right. a response of anger or disgust or rage or maybe contempt. Right. And those... effective, those emotions often are problematic for deliberation. I mean, so how do we move past, or how do we make rage productive? That's a tough question.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know if it's so much about making it productive. I mean, I think it's in part about recognizing, you know, the legitimate areas
right.
that come. I mean, there's time,
right.
there's, you know, my student who responded angrily.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like it was a legitimate response. This student, you know, he was one of the people who had worked hardest to cultivate our community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so when it came under attack, of course he feels attacked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can we react in ways that recognizes the legitimacy of those feelings of anger and
right.
without diminishing them,
right.
but also says, okay, look, a response rooted in that is ultimately, over the long course, going to be a destructive one.
Yes.
One that is not going to be able to cultivate communities in the way that we want and be transformative in our relations with one another.
Right.
That's hard to see when, you know, the Oklahoma City bombing happens and, you know, your kids are involved, right? I mean, that's difficult. And yet there are people who do it, you
right.
know, who can do that.
I was in Oklahoma City the day
were
that
you?
Happened, actually,
wow.
for a field trip.
And wow.
my parents were frightened, obviously.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But, yeah, that's a really interesting... I mean, that we're getting at, for me, what are the central problems of citizenship and deliberation,
and
I think.
And I think the project that we're starting to think about here at Penn State
mm-hmm.
with regard to cultivating or thinking about virtue ethics and,
mm-hmm.
and how what we're really talking about is, in part, what you said about Jefferson versus Clay. It's about a kind of character and how they respond to invective
right.
that we need to think about how we're educating students and ourselves.
Right, right, right. I don't know that I want to hold Jefferson up as our
no,
character
okay,
model.
Fair enough. I will not do that. But there is a sense
but
in which,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And Jefferson is someone who was rigorously trained in classical rhetoric and classical philosophy.
Right.
I mean, he read Aristotle and Cicero and the originals. And I was wondering, are there more productive uses of invective, more maybe celebratory? And I wonder if it would be maybe what we would have to do, and this is something I don't do in the article, but something I've been thinking quite a bit about, is that in Aristotle there were topics of invective. Topoi
yeah. Yeah.
is the term he used. Standard argumentative tactics
right.
that if you were going to praise someone, you would focus on these 10 things.
Right.
And if you were going to blame someone, you would focus on these 10 things.
Right.
And so if you go back and read festival orations from ancient Greece, or if you read Cicero's letters, the Philippics,
right.
they're formulaic. There are kind of topics and procedures of invective. And I'm wondering if maybe those topics don't translate well to democracy, or maybe they do and we've forgotten them.
Well, and I think there's a way in which we could go back even to the very beginning of our discussion with regard to reproof and invective, because the thing that I find one way of dealing with the damaging dimensions of invective, it seems to me, is with a certain playfulness, a certain humor, a certain, right? So that's something that Socrates, I think, does really nicely.
Absolutely.
And that's where I think, that's where I think in some ways the anonymity question comes into play. I feel like, I could, know a student or know somebody and hear some invective language from them and recognize, well, in the context of who this is, I see what they're doing. They're trying to be provocative. They're trying to get us to think about something,
Right.
And so that makes sense.
Right.
And we can give them back something either, humorous or, depending on who they are. You lose that. I think we in contemporary politics also lose that sense of humor, that sense of playfulness that is really important, because if you don't have it, then it becomes too life and death serious.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I think about Hannah Arendt and On Violence, where she talks about the optimal response to hypocrisy or maybe invective. She doesn't talk about invective, but is laughter.
Right.
Being able to laugh that off.
But there's also different kinds of laughter, too.
Of course.
Right? There's derisive laughter, the kind
Absolutely.
Of laughter that
there's the contemptuous laughter that says that I'm better than you.
Right.
There's smirking laughter that might not be productive for identification, for a relationship.
Right.
And so maybe laughter is not right, but I think
it's a playfulness, maybe.
Playfulness, I think, is better.
Yeah.
I think that, to me, the playful dimensions of democratic deliberation, we don't really talk much about that, because often the things we're deliberating about are so serious,
right.
That it would seem to be inappropriate to be playful when we're talking about war or healthcare.
Well, and this is what actually, since you brought Sarah Palin up at the end of your at the end of your essay, maybe we could talk just a minute about that.
Sure.
I felt like Joe Biden's way of responding in that debate with her had just enough dimension of play that wasn't derisive. It was not it didn't put her down. It would have been bad if it did that. But he had a smile, and he also sort of he engaged her in a kind of a playful way that wasn't putting her down, but was sort of taking joy in the back and forth of their discussion, and also recognizing that she had some rhetorical moves there that she was doing that were actually calling him Joe and stuff, and he appreciated that. You could see a smile on his face, and I thought that really worked for him pretty well in that debate.
I think you're right.
Yeah,
that's a good example of maybe how one can respond to invective, and that was an incredibly challenging rhetorical situation for him, because he had to, he had to not seem as though he was placing himself above her, and I think he did a good job in that debate. A lot of people say that she won the debate, but she's an amazing populist rhetorician in a lot of ways, and I think that is a moment of she invites us to think about how do we respond to invective, to claims that have no evidence, to character assassination, because it can be incredibly effective, poisoning the well.
But again, I think the response has to be from one of a certain kind of grounding.
Right.
And I think that's why Obama's response ultimately was so effective, because he didn't respond out of insecurity.
Right.
And one of the things I do admire about him is that he never seems to respond out of insecurity.
Right.
It really is about a certain kind of vision of what he wants to do, who he is. I think that's something that's important for us to think about. How does one cultivate that in oneself and in one's students?
Yes, absolutely.
A sense of security, a sense of grounding.
And how do we prevent that from sliding into dogmatism, which would seem to be the other pole, right?
Right.
Radical insecurity and radical dogmatism.
Right.
Invective often, I think, springs from one and leads to the other.
Right.
And if we're trying to find some sort of middle ground, you know, a golden mean, how do we do that in our students?
Right.
Very interesting.
Yeah. No, I think, and this is an ongoing project, I think I'm looking forward to doing some work on that with you and with
Me
others
too.
Here at Penn State, and I really thank you for coming on to the
digital. Thanks for having me, Chris. This has been wonderful.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You'll find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of The Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for The Digital Dialogue. This has been The Digital Dialogue.